It's Thursday, April 25th, and all the president's men have been indicted again. We start here. Arizona's attorney general files criminal charges against key Trump aides.
Every action by Donald Trump and his allies has not gone unnoticed.
The 2020 election continues to reverberate. We'll break it all down.
We will not stop. We will not rest.
Protest encampments have spread nationwide, and so have the responses from police.
There is concern that they are going to stay on campuses for the long haul.
We'll take you to the latest campus where arrests have been made. And President Biden signs a bill that sets the clock tick-tocking.
So basically what we're looking at is a year for this for sale to go through.
So what happens next? The business world is scrolling furiously to find out. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
Presidents have to be given total immunity. They have to be allowed to do their job.
Later today, the Supreme Court will hear a case about former President Donald Trump and whether he can be charged with any crime for anything he did while in office. Specifically, this involves the case around January 6th and whether Trump tried to illegally subvert the 2020 presidential election. And part of the government's case there is that Trump and his top allies tried to submit slates of so-called fake electors. These are the people who, through the Electoral College, technically elect the president on behalf of their state. Even though Biden won these states fair and square, there was this push to have Republican lawmakers just say, the vote was illegitimate. These are the people we'd like to do the choosing instead. That doesn't just have the potential to be a federal crime. It could be a state crime, too. And last night, Arizona officials announced indictments against those so-called fake electors. And in a twist, they also indicted several people close to the former president. Let's bring in ABC's John Santucci, who leads our investigations coverage. John, who is being charged here?
So, Brad, this is really interesting. This is 11 fake electors, some of which, you know, obviously held major roles in the Republican Party and Arizona state politics that have been indicted. But, Brad, it doesn't stop there. Based on our team's reading of this indictment, some of which is redacted, it does appear that many close aides to Donald Trump, current and former, were also indicted. And it's a who's who, Brad. It includes Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, Boris Epstein, who still works for Donald Trump, even Christina Bob, one of his lawyers that was involved in some of the investigations that have gone on. It's just a remarkable reminder that, you know, we talk about all of the cases that have really haunted Donald Trump, right? You talk about the Manhattan DA's case, the special counsel case. Obviously, Fulton County, Georgia, a big one that involved Donald Trump, Rudy, and Meadows. But Arizona was another state that Donald Trump and his allies were trying to overturn the election there. And now the state attorney general has said an indictment, and here we are.
And so these names, like you said, huge names, very close to Donald Trump. What about Trump himself?
So Trump is not indicted here. Big difference from the Georgia case, Brad. He's an unindicted co-conspirator. So it doesn't mention Donald Trump by name, but based on our reading of the indictment, it appears Donald Trump is unindicted co-conspirator number one. And it basically means that Donald Trump was a part of the actions and activities, some of which obviously illegal based on the attorney general's interpretation of actions. And thus those individuals, including Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows, were indicted for their actions.
Yeah. Can you tell me about like what the alleged scheme was here? Because they could have just indicted the Arizona officials. Michigan, for example, is doing something similar where they just stuck to those people. Why did this go further?
So this went further because remember, so much of this was visible to us, right? We saw Rudy Giuliani on the ground with some of his top allies and aides lobbying officials.
Let's say there were 5 million illegal aliens in Arizona. It is it's beyond credulity that a few hundred thousand didn't vote.
We obviously know, based on even what we've seen in Georgia, the phone calls that Mark Meadows and other top aides to Donald Trump were making.
I'd like to see if there's a way that we could resolve this so it comes out well for everyone. We're all Republicans. I think we all have the same goal.
And here's the point. Think about Rusty Bowers, right? The former speaker of the Arizona House.
He said that they did have proof. And I asked him, do you have names? For example, we have 200,000 illegal immigrants, some large number.
He testified before the House January 6th committee, indicating the phone calls and lobbying and the pressure he was under by Donald Trump and his close aides.
And I said, do you have their names? Yes. Will you give them to me? Yes. The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy.
Every action by Donald Trump and his allies has not gone unnoticed and didn't go unnoticed by law enforcement in these various states. You talk about Michigan. We obviously know Georgia. Now add Arizona to the list, Brad. It's also just this crystal clear visualization based on this indictment from the Arizona State Attorney General that there was a real effort, documents, paperwork, lobbying that was done to really build this alternate slate of electors to say outright that in these people's opinion, Joe Biden did not legitimately win the 2020 race. In their eyes, it was Donald Trump, and clearly they would do anything possible, even lie, even allegedly commit a crime, Brad, to make that happen.
Right, and as we record this, no response yet from Trump or any of these, they will be defendants as they're arraigned after these indictments. Huge news here breaking overnight. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Brad.
All right, next up on Start here, these college protests are getting intense. We're back in a bit. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. When you think about successful protest movements, most have a few things in common. One, they're passionate. Two, they're nonviolent. And three, they have specific demands, pressuring leaders to make real concessions. Well, last week, students at Columbia University in New York started setting up tents on campus. These were nonviolent protesters, but they were passionate. They were nearly impossible to avoid. And what these students were asking for was simple. They wanted their school to divest itself from any financial relationships with the state of Israel. Within 24 hours, you could see this having an effect, to the point where other protesters from around the city started joining them, in some cases making the scene more chaotic and more unnerving, especially to Jewish students who were now being screamed at for any visible support for Israel. Those scenes from Columbia have galvanized more student groups across the country. We've seen encampments spring up on other campuses, and yesterday, this seemed to explode. I want to go to ABC's chief national correspondent, Matt Gutman, who is on the campus of USC in Los Angeles right now. Matt, these scenes are literally coast to coast at this point. What are you seeing?
They are, Brad. We've seen protests virtually coast to coast. Obviously, you just mentioned New York, but there's also NYU, not just Columbia. There's Harvard and Brown. There's been protests at the University of Texas, Austin. Those protesters were forcefully removed as well by campus security and police.
Let him go!
20 people arrested there yesterday. We also had people protesting in Humboldt County at University of California, Humboldt, way up in the northern wilds of California. Arrests made there as well. And of course, here at USC, one person was sort of detained.
Hands up!
And then the crowd sort of began rushing campus security. It was not violent. And the protesters, by and large, across the country, asking for the same thing.
Close riots! We will not stop! We will not rest! It's close riots!
For their universities to divest from anything related to Israel or companies that make a profit off of the war taking place in Gaza right now.
So if they're nonviolent, I mean, why the police response? Because clearly this schools and local authorities have deemed a lot of these out of hand.
There is an issue with these protesters setting up tents. There is concern that they are going to stay on campuses for the long haul. There's also concern that there have been activists who've intermingled with the students and the faculty, and they're not allowed to be on campus. Here at USC, we've been told that about 50% of the activists that we're seeing protesting, certainly yesterday and possibly again today, are people who are not affiliated with the university. And there are security concerns about that. Also, commencement is not far away. And campus security told me they're just not going to allow that to happen. They do not want people sleeping here, protesting, chanting, yes, sleeping on campus, in tents, in the quad, absolutely not.
Well, and the schools seem uncomfortable with these protests, right? Because while students here and there have described being punched or assaulted, a lot of the incidents that we've heard about involve this just threatening, vile speech. Like at Columbia, we saw someone holding up a sign, basically suggesting Hamas's military wing target some of the pro-Israel demonstrators. There were allegedly chants of, like, we are Hamas, and people saying, we don't want you here, Zionists. And then pro-Palestinian demonstrators talk about how you can't show up to one of these things. You can't protest without being worried about being suspended or threatened or doxxed so that people never hire you. But, I mean, speech is kind of different. So how do schools decide when and how to involve the police?
It really depends which school and how significant the protests are. Here at USC, it has been campus security that it's handling it. At the University of Texas Austin, UT, it was state police. That's a state university school. And that's the threat, that if these campus protests get out of hand, if the protesters try to stay too long, if they try to really embed themselves on campus with tents, or if they look like they're trying to stay for any long period of time, then the major threat is that they would bring in not campus security, but state police or local authorities.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of moderates are, like, these are concerning images, because on one hand, you want to celebrate free speech on college campuses. There's a long, proud tradition of that in this country. On the other hand, like, these scenes are so intense that you can imagine how scary and disruptive it is. I know, like, today is USC's final day of classes. There are Jewish students afraid to attend class. So a lot of moderates are kind of like, ugh. But then on the far left, you got a lot of protesters who are enjoying the visibility. On the right now, you're seeing, like, Governor Greg Abbott in Texas saying, like, all these protesters should go to jail. You're seeing politicians show up at events. It sounds like it is now becoming a galvanizing force on the right as well.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson met with students at Columbia.
They place a target on the backs of Jewish students in the United States and here on this campus.
Many of them telling him that these protests do make them feel threatened on campus.
The majority of my friends, especially Jewish friends, feel a sense of insecurity at this time.
In addition to that, Mike Johnson saying that, hey, he's going to talk to President Biden about this. He's going to bring it to the president. And he's going to say that someone's going to stop these protests across the country.
As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear.
He said he's going to even urge the president to call in the National Guard if necessary and appropriate. Of course, there is a long and very sordid history of the National Guard interfering with protests, anti-war protests in this country. Unclear that the president is going to want to go back to that again. But obviously, this is something that is in the zeitgeist in America and that people are thinking about on the left and, of course, on the right side of the aisle as well.
Wow, yeah. I mean, you can see how these encampments have kind of upended the playbook, and now is the encampments are becoming part of a playbook in themselves. Matt Gutman, there on the campus of USC. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Yesterday, President Biden signed into law a package of foreign aid bills. Most notably, we're sending $60 billion in aid to Ukraine, which Biden said would start moving within hours.
In the next few hours, literally the few hours, we're going to begin sending in equipment to Ukraine for air defense munitions, for artillery, for rocket systems, and armored vehicles.
This bill originated in the House of Representatives. Another version had actually been floating around in the Senate, but this was the one that was approved in both chambers. And one of the big differences here was tucked inside this House bill. It's a measure that could potentially ban TikTok. Yeah, the app with the Chinese parent company, the app that reportedly has 170 million American users. That's half the population. Well, as of today, the clock is ticking on a forced sale of TikTok. So what happens now? ABC's Elizabeth Schulze has been covering all this. She covers politics and economics. So Elizabeth, I feel like this went from theory to reality very quickly. Could this app actually go away? What is in this measure?
Very quickly, Brad. And, you know, we've been talking so much about this possibility of could TikTok actually be banned? It's been back and forth for years. But the fact is, we're closer to that becoming a reality now than we have ever been. But it's still far away.
The yeas are 79. The nays are 18.
This provision in the law that was signed by President Biden basically gives TikTok 9 months to force a sale from its Chinese owner. Remember, TikTok is owned by ByteDance, which is a company based in China. There have been concerns from lawmakers, and this escalated pretty quickly in the past couple of months, that because TikTok's owned by a Chinese company, the Chinese government can get access to Americans' data. It can manipulate Americans' opinions, possibly spread misinformation, propaganda, influence elections, or have an undue influence on so many, as you say, 170 million users.
This app is a spy balloon in Americans' phones. It is a modern-day Trojan horse of the CCP used to surveil and exploit America's personal information.
TikTok is a gun aimed at Americans' heads.
Basically, what the U.S. government in this law now is saying is that TikTok needs to divest from that Chinese company. It has 9 months to do that, and then President Biden could extend that for another 90 days. So basically what we're looking at is a year for this forced sale to go through. If the sale doesn't happen, then the app could be banned in the U.S. Now, keep in mind, like, it's not like TikTok's just going to disappear from your phone in a year if this ban happens. But what the provision in the law says is that basically the app couldn't get updated in the app stores. So eventually it just wouldn't work anymore. And then web servers couldn't really host the app. So at some point, that would mean that it's no longer usable and effectively would be banned at that point.
I see. I see. Like, you're kind of restricting how it's used on these devices.
Exactly.
If they sell, who would they sell it to? Like, I keep wondering, what if no one wants to buy it? Or what if they can't find a price that they agree on? What happens?
Well, and really the question is about the price. Because if you ask any company, whether it's a big consumer company or a tech company, a lot of people would like to buy TikTok. It is an incredibly valuable asset. It has 170 million users who are glued to the platform. It has the data on those users. And it has this algorithm that is incredibly valuable because the algorithm keeps people there. It keeps people creating content all the time.
TikTok allows me that unique ability to, you know, just go and be myself in front of a large audience and have people support my business because they like who I am and what I'm about.
When you talk to analysts who are looking at this possibility of a sale, some of the biggest names that they throw out are big tech companies like Oracle or Microsoft. Oracle could be an obvious buyer because it already works with TikTok to host some of those data servers. Remember, this is a point TikTok's been making, that it has a lot of its servers already in the U.S., and Oracle is actually the company that it works with on that. So that could make sense. You also have out there the possibility of a Walmart. I mean, for a big consumer company that's also doing a lot of e-commerce, maybe they would want access to all of that digital gold, basically, that TikTok has. The question really is, can any of those companies pay the price? One analyst I talked to said he thinks that TikTok right now is valued at about $100 billion. That's a number that a lot of people throw out.
$100 billion?
$100 billion with a B. That is massive. That is a lot of cash to put forward. So it would take a pretty big company to be able to put that kind of money forward. The other option is, let's say a group of
companies get together. The former Treasury Secretary under former President Trump, Steve Mnuchin, has proposed this idea of a consortium. Basically, a bunch of investors come together, put up the capital, and then they kind of like co-own TikTok. The issue with this sale, and so even if you have someone who has that much money, the question would still be is, would the Chinese government allow it? Because why would the Chinese government want to give up this incredibly valuable algorithm? And they've basically suggested so far they don't want to give it up. So then, if China tries to block a sale, is there a way that maybe a company could buy TikTok without buying the algorithm? So could you buy the brand, all the users, the data, but not actually buy what its kind of crown jewel is? Maybe that's something that China would allow. Is there a way that the company could go public through an IPO? That wouldn't mean that another company has to pay all this money. So there's options that are being floated out there. But in the interim, there's going to be this kind of legal battle where TikTok is now saying, Brad, they want to fight this. This whole law is illegal.
Make no mistake. This is a ban. A ban on TikTok and a ban on you and your voice.
They say that this is unconstitutional and that the sale shouldn't even have to be a topic in the first place.
Yeah, let's talk about the fight in court, because that seems like the thing that could push this well beyond 9 months, perhaps. I mean, what is the argument from TikTok? And I guess, could China tell its parent company, like, nope, don't do it. Don't let them do it.
So TikTok signaled yesterday that it will file a lawsuit challenging this forced sale. And it has yet to do that. That'll probably come out within a couple of weeks.
It's actually ironic, because the freedom of expression on TikTok reflects the same American values that make the United States a beacon of freedom.
That will then take some time to get litigated. But most investors who are keeping an eye on this say there's no way that these conversations about a sale or an IPO or anything like that when it comes to how to get TikTok free of that Chinese parent are going to happen until this kind of legal battle plays out. Probably at least going to consume the next couple of months. I mean, I think the really important thing for users to know, for like people who are on TikTok all the time every day, is nothing's going to change in the app. As this litigation is going forward, even if there are talks behind the scenes about a buyer, that's not going to change the fact that at least for probably a year, the app's going to stay as it is. And that's something that TikTok's making a point of saying too. For now, proceed as planned. Don't flee. Everything's fine. We're going to fight this.
Right. And if you got companies that aren't allowed to buy it for antitrust reasons or whatever, you think that lowers the prices even more, which is why TikTok is saying, like, you guys are forcing us into a fire sale. We're not going to get anything for this. Elizabeth Schulze, really helpful. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, it's one of the heaviest trophies in sports, but it's not weighing on his mind anymore. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Yesterday, Reggie Bush got a piece of history back.
Bush steps outside, 35, 40, 45.
If you don't remember, before Reggie Bush was a star running back in the NFL, back in the early aughts, he was a star running back at USC.
And that's Reggie Bush being Reggie Bush.
He was part of what some called the greatest championship game ever played. And in 2005, he won college football's highest honor, the Heisman Trophy.
Reggie Bush from USC.
But shortly after, reports started bubbling up that Bush and his family had accepted gifts from a local agent, like help with their debt and a rental home they didn't have to pay for. Bush denied any impropriety, but then this agent came out by name suing him, saying he had given the Bush family almost $300,000 and wanted it back. All of this would have made Bush ineligible to play college ball at the time. So, after an investigation, arbitration, and defamation lawsuits, the NCAA stripped USC of its national championship, and the Heisman Trust asked for their trophy back. He relented and sent it to them.
The NCAA determined that his violations meant he was ineligible to play in 2005, the year he won.
Well, think about where we are nowadays. College athletes are allowed to work with agents. They're allowed to get endorsement deals. Some make far more than what Bush was allegedly promised. Gradually, the tone around him shifted.
I'm not giving up that Heisman if I was Reggie Bush.
If there was cheating, that's one thing.
The fact that a guy made his family a little more comfortable.
And this is something, we're not talking about O.J. Simpson here.
Another Heisman winner, Johnny Manziel, said he wouldn't have anything to do with the award until Bush got his trophy back. Well, yesterday, ESPN reported that Bush has been reunited with his Heisman. After 14 years, the Heisman Trust has given him a key part of his legacy back. But this will set off more questions, like will the NCAA restore USC, the school's 2004 championship? Does Bush deserve to be treated by today's standards even if he did break the rules at the time? Because even if rules are unjust, lots of other players conceivably scrimped and saved to get by. So does it matter if he didn't have to? Perhaps we already have our answer. After all, the original Trojans understood history is always seen through the eyes of the victor. Also, when you see people lugging around this Heisman Trophy, it is outrageously heavy looking. Like, it looks like you're just carrying your teammate. They're just cast in bronze. I wonder how much it costs to ship this thing back and forth from New York to wherever it's going. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.